Hi, I'm Margie Ligon, Director of Personal Enrichment Programs here at the University of Minnesota, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the season finale of Headliners. Since last October, it really has been a great year. Since last October, we've discussed such compelling stories as the I-35W bridge collapse, global warming, U.S.-China relations. We've met scholars whose research took them by bicycle into Latino communities all across the country, as well as into a huge void in outer space. And we learned about a theory developed here at the university that won this year's Nobel Prize in Economics. But the consistent and truly remarkable thing is that each month the discussions have been animated by your questions and your insights. So thank you very much for making this such a lively monthly forum. And while this is the last Headliners event of this year, there are many continuing education opportunities coming up this spring and summer that I think will be of interest to you, including there's a brand new roster of complete scholar classes starting next week. There are two great conversations coming up, one in May and one in June. We have a day-long Learning Life Fest planned for Saturday, May 17th, that will explore the question, what makes a renewable life? And then beginning in June, a series of new Curiosity Camps, which is a unique summer camp for adults that just won an Innovative Program Award from the national academic organization. So I hope to see you at some of these events coming up in spring and summer, and then again next October for a new season of Headliners. The wave of home foreclosures sweeping the nation has had a devastating effect here in Minnesota. This year alone, foreclosures in the state are expected to hit a new record high. And without government intervention, many believe that this financial crisis is only going to continue to get worse for the next several years. Prompted by this situation, the Minnesota State Legislature is currently considering several bills intended to help Minnesota families stay in their homes and protect our communities from the problems associated with vacant and abandoned properties. Tonight's speaker worked on some of those bills. He is one of this country's foremost authorities on the foreclosure crisis and has been widely quoted on the subject in the Star Tribune, Minnesota Public Radio, Twin Cities Public Television, and WCCO. Let me introduce tonight's speaker. Prentice Cox is clinical professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He received his law degree here and has prosecuted numerous nationally recognized cases involving predatory lending, subprime mortgage lending, credit card practices, in some cases it's a crisis, and telemarketing fraud. Prior to joining the U of M faculty, he served as Assistant Attorney General and head of the Consumer Enforcement Division in the Minnesota Attorney General's office, and he helped research and draft Minnesota's anti-predatory lending law, which is the strongest such law in the country, and the Subprime Foreclosure Deferment Act, which is currently on the floor of both the House and the Senate. Will you please join me in welcoming Prentice Cox?
Margie was nice enough to offer me a couple of comp tickets, so I asked my two teenage daughters, I said, I have a couple of comp tickets to this. You've heard me speak before. Would you like to come? My ninth grader looked at me and said, someone's going to pay to hear you speak. Incredulously. And then said, I would pay to hear you not speak. This was after we did geometry homework, so that may have had an influence. All right. We're going to talk about the foreclosure crisis today. And most of the time I'm going to spend talking about it is going to be focusing on how we got here, basically. And then I'm going to, at the end, I'm going to talk about this bill that we have at the legislature to try to address the problem substantially. After that, let's have questions and have a chance to talk about it, and we can range on any subject of interest to you related to this. The short version of this, I've dealt with the press for a long time, being the head of the consumer division at the AG's office. You do cases, you talk to the press. and then doing consumer law. And I joke that I have two quotes: "They were bad," and "Be careful." And the summary of this speech is, you know, it is very, very bad. Now, a year ago, that would have come as news to many people. 2 years ago, I would have said the same thing. It is going to be very, very bad. In fact, I was terrible dinner conversation, because anyone who would listen, I would tell them, you don't realize how bad these lending practices are and how huge, how many dollars and how many people are taking these loans and how much it's expanded and how really horrendous the underlying lending practices are. Most people did not invite me back to dinner when I didn't manage to control myself. But then everybody knows it. 2 years ago, no one would heard the word subprime. It was the word of the year in 2007. So let's talk about how we got here and what's going on. This is the number of foreclosures in Hennepin and Ramsey County for over a 20-year period. And you'll see I call it a hockey stick graph. The first 20 years, it's very steady. You know, draw a line around 1,100, goes up and down about 20% around that line. Really doesn't change much. You get to 2005, and I remember, you know, we were saying, wow, there were 1,500 foreclosures. I said, it's going to get more. It could hit 2,000 next year. I was wrong. It hit 3,000. It doubled in 2006. In 2007, it doubled again. It was almost 6,000 foreclosures in Hennepin County. When I say foreclosures, I mean actual sheriff sales. And foreclosure process essentially has two parts. One part, you're in default, and they start the foreclosure process, and they send you notices, they send notices out and that sort of thing. And during that time, you can reinstate your loan by paying the deficiency at that point. If you don't do that, then you have a sheriff's sale, which in Minnesota just amounts to the lender bidding the credit 99.9% of the time that's owed. We're only counting foreclosure sheriff sales. We're not counting the number of people who went into foreclosure and cured. So the number of foreclosure sheriff sales was almost 6,000 in 2007 in Hennepin County. Ramsey County had the same exact hockey stick kind of graph. The first 2 months, I didn't check March yet, the first 2 months of 2008, up another 60%. So we should be somewhere north or around about 9,000 foreclosures. It just continues to escalate astronomically. Just in case you think it's just you're thinking, oh, well, that's just a problem in North Minneapolis and Frogtown. No such luck. It's up everywhere. All the metro counties are up. It's up everywhere in the state. It was a little lagging outside the metro area in terms of the explosion, but it's actually, this year, the initial evidence is that's actually worse percentage-wise outside of the metro area. But the numbers are very consistent. If you look at the 06 to 07 numbers from Housing Link here, they were projected 07, but they came in very close to this. If you look at the 06, 07 numbers from Housing Link here, it doesn't matter where you lived. Seven County, 83%, Greater Minnesota, 84%. All right, so you're saying times are bad. Well, not really. During the time that this explosion in foreclosures occurred, long-term interest rates were relatively stable. If you look at the blue line there, the solid blue line at the top, they came down. They were decreasing or only slightly increasing during the time when this foreclosure explosion was occurring. Here's the Hennepin County unemployment rate. So it's targeted right down to the same level of data. It was actually falling. Unemployment was falling at the time of the explosion in the foreclosures. The moral of that story is it was not the result of economic factors. It wasn't a spike in interest rate, long-term mortgage rates. It wasn't unemployment. It wasn't income drop. You could draw that line too. This was a result of mortgage lending practices, and a particular type of mortgage lending practices, which is what I'm going to talk to you about for most of the rest of the time. There is one little economic indicator of note. Short-term interest rates spiked along with the foreclosure. From ahistoric lows of darn near free money to basically a 20-year average or slightly under a 20-year average to about 5%. Now, that's meaningful. If those interest rates had spiked a few years before like that, it would not have had that big an impact because the number of people with ARM loans that were tied to that short-term interest rate was just not that large. But by the time the foreclosure came, the underlying terms of mortgages have shifted. So the importance of that short-term rate became more important. However, even if you hadn't seen that spike in short-term rates, you still would have seen a spike in foreclosures. Quite as high, but it would have been startling. All right, how do we get here? One word, subprime. The subprime mortgage crisis is what it's called, and it's called that for a darn good reason. That's how we got here. If you look at this chart, you're going to see the bar graph, the kind of bluish green. That's the number, the dollar volume in billions of over on the left. Those numbers in billions of subprime mortgages. The black dots is the percentage of overall mortgage originations that were subprime. You'll see that drops in 2001, 2002, 2003, even when the number of subprime loans is steady or growing. And that's because that was a refi boom, right? Go back to that short-term interest rate. Interest rates were dropping, refi. So prime mortgages were being refied, so the overall percentage was lower. But if you kind of even that out, it's a fairly steady growth as a percentage. The percentage was basically negligible in 1997. And there starts our story. Subprime lending, there's nothing wrong with it. It's a good idea. I'm sorry that it has essentially gone away in this market. It provides credit to people who have impaired credit. Nothing wrong with that, as long as you're prudent, and as long as it's reasonable. And there's nothing wrong with charging people more if they have bad credit ratings. You should. It's a higher risk to the lender. In 1997, that was a niche market. It was a very small market. That kind of lending occurred through mostly niche lenders, not major mortgage lenders, or even affiliates of major mortgage lenders in most cases. And that's what the market was. 1998 was an explosion in subprime lending. And that is when I got my first experience with subprime lending, that year. A group called First Alliance Mortgage Company, FAMCO. And it was when I was the Minnesota Attorney General's office, and you call the Attorney General's office, everybody knows that, somebody answers the phone. In the old days, nobody answered it, but somebody theoretically answered the phone. That got much, much better. And they talked to you about your consumer problem, right? Well, one of those people from the phone room came in and said, I've got this loan, and the guy faxed me the documents after I talked to him, and here they are, terrible-looking fax. Remember the 1990s, technology wasn't so good, government technology was worse. And so I look at this fax, and it's kind of blurry, and I'm like, oh, that's not what it appears to be. He said, this person was charged 20% of their loan amount in costs. And I said, no, 2%. They got a pretty good deal, probably somewhere around 2%. It's just a type, just get a better copy of it from them. Let's just make sure. Comes back 2 days later, says, no, well, this person was charged 20%. I'm looking at a better copy. I'm going, 20%? Holy, unbelievable. I just thought about it for about an hour, and then I went over to my investigator, the tough one. I loved her. She was great. Whenever I got a complaint, it's like, hey, somebody's on hold for you for a complaint about someone in your division, a citizen. I'm like, what's her name? But I loved her. She got all the complaints I'd hear. I'd go by her office, and she'd be saying, listen, you SOB, you're going to refund that. And I'm like, didn't hear. She's tough. So I went to her office, and I said, go down. She's a former realtor. I said, go down to Ramsey County and just pull whatever you can find for the last few months for this lender. I can't believe this. It's 20%. I never heard of such a thing. And I said, just pull the names, call the people up, and talk to them. Find out what they got for their loan. So she comes back about 3 days later, as I recall, says, I got to talk to three people who went and looked at their loan papers. I said, find out what they paid in costs. I talked to three people, and they all came back, and sure enough, they were all right around 20%. You know, maybe 15, one was 25%. I couldn't believe it. I was just floored. And he said, and none of them knew it until I asked them to go look at their papers. I just said, fine, pull them all now. You know, go back as far as you can go, pull them all, start calling people. And it turned out we eventually filed the case against First Alliance Mortgage Company. It turned out 20-something percent was the average loan cost, and 90% of these people got exploding arms, which we're all now familiar with. At the time, that, you know, I invented that term with this case, where the average arm went up 3%, even if interest rates stayed stable for these consumers, okay? They were all in their chair. None of them knew it. Practically none of them knew it. They had no idea. And so we kind of reversed, by talking to these people, we sort of reversed engineered the sales practices. And this was the beginning of my education with subprime lending. They got them in, they got them to cry. We later learned that they hired only car salesmen because they thought that fit best with their program. One of these car salesmen, it's called F&I guys, the back end, the people who sell you the loans and the insurance, had a crisis of conscience and came into our office. And that's when I knew my killer case was invincible. When the F&I car guy comes in with a crisis of conscience, you know you have a consumer fraud case. So this guy comes in, you know, I mean, it's we'd already reverse engineered it. That, you know, it's this 3-hour sales presentation. They get people to cry, you know, and they bamboozle them. They convince them that stupid government APR number, it's so dumb, it's better if it's high. And then they had this whole explanation of how they convince people that it's better to have a high APR, which I won't go into. That was 1998. And we went after FAMCO. We reached a settlement with them. Other states and the FTC eventually sued them. When they were on 2020 in the front page of the New York Times, they declared bankruptcy a week later. And that was the first major predatory lending case in the country, at least by government regulators, probably by anybody. All right, well, this continues. Did a couple more cases. You get to about 2002. We do this case against Household. Remember Benefit? You've got an audience of experienced people here. Remember the old Beneficial jingle? Okay. I wish my daughter had decided to come because I could embarrass her by singing. But, you know, never do a loan you trust, but if you must, you know. I forget what it is. What is it? Beneficial. Somebody got a voice and remember these words? Never take a loan. Anyway, it's an old company. Beneficial. Great. It's just subprime lending, right? That's what they did. You know, they were one of these street front lenders. And they merged with Household to become the largest subprime lender in America. And then they got into, at this time, you know, late 90s, they went heavily into mortgage lending, subprime mortgage lending. So we did a case. We eventually, you know, I was on the negotiating committee of that. We eventually reached a settlement where they paid more than $500 million and almost all restitution to consumers. We had a 38-page injunction about how they were going to do their operations. We all went out and had a beer. This was December of 2002. Take a look at where that is on the chart. And I remember we sat down. I was with the Attorney General of Iowa. I was with the Banking Commissioner of New York and about 4 or 5 assistant attorney generals. We said, well, you know, we've done something. You know, we have this 38-page injunction. We're going to change the practices of this industry. Everybody's going to see we're serious. The largest consumer settlement in history other than tobacco cases. We're going to get this under control because, my gosh, it's up to about 8 or 10% of all loans are subprime. That's outrageous. We've got to bring this down, way down. This money's ridiculous. Foolish us. Well, this was the beginning, not the end. I thought we were at the beginning of getting this under control and it would start dropping from this absurdly high level of 8-10% of loans to something more reasonable. In fact, it was on the verge of exploding. And that's exactly what it did. It exploded from 2002 to 2006. Fell apart in 2007. It's an old graph. To 2006, so by the time you were done in 2006, not only had the actual loan volume essentially tripled or more, but the percentage had gone up to 22% at its height. 22% of all new mortgage originations were subprime. If you actually looked at those files, I initiated and led the investigation against AmeriQuest, which was at the time we started it, the largest subprime lender. All you had to do was pull any random selection of 10 or 15 of those files and look at them. I mean, it just, anybody in this room could have done it and looked at them and they would have been astounded, you know, the appraisal. I mean, I remember one appraisal. It's a home in St. Louis Park. The comparable was an Orono, you know. I mean, I think they probably could have found a home closer than Orono for St. Louis Park to get comparable value, but, you know, they were inflating appraisals right and left. My friend Kathleen Keast, who I love at the Center for Responsible Lending, there's new rules on inflated appraisal. Of course, a dollar too little and day too late, but there's new rules that are developing on inflated appraisals. And she said, well, it's really hard to write rules because it's kind of like the old, you know, bathroom, you know, scrawl, you know, Mike is easy. Go to him for appraisals. And, you know, it's kind of what it was. You know, they knew who the appraisers were who would give them whatever value they wanted. But that wasn't even the worst part. You know, you had almost 50% of their loans were stated income. You know, people didn't have to prove they had the income. They just said, I do this. And again, you know, we just pulled a random selection of loans. You see the same thing over and over. The loan officers were saying, I'll get you the loan. Just say you're, you know, just write this down. Can you do that? Yeah, that's how it all is. You know, everybody does that. Trust me. You know, so you got a loan after loan of, you know, an antique dealer making, you know, $4,000 a month or this and that. I mean, just really, not even a large selection. We started calling people to sort of verify the obvious. You know, we found out one of the people who was an architect, you know, making X thousand dollars a month as an architect was blind. Unlikely. There was an older couple in southern Minnesota where, you know, he did light construction on the side and she did house cleaning on the side, again, for large sums of money. I thought this was doubtful when I saw their ages were late 70s and early 80s, so we called them up, and, you know, the guy who did light construction actually is one of those walkers with an oxygen tank. I mean, this stuff was crazy. I mean, this wasn't close, okay? But it had exploded, and the lending had exploded. Now, there was a reason for this, which gets us to Bear Stearns. Remember that short-term interest rates? Free money, you know? Well, it was really cheap. They didn't have anywhere to go. There was no return. Subprime lending was very profitable. And what happened was that they split the risk and the reward here. So the people who originated these loans, Ameriquest, New Century, they're all the really big subprime lenders, made all their money up front, you know? So they would get the fees up front, and that's how they made their money. At one point in the Ameriquest case, we were negotiating with them. I said, look, you know, you're going to have to pay us $1 billion. And the guy pulled out his keys. The general counsel threw them on the table. He said, where do you think you're going to get that here? You know, we got a building we're in. We got some equipment. That's it. You know, we just fold. We go away if you want $1 billion. We're nothing here. We don't own anything. And we do these loans. We package them. We sell them to Wall Street. Wall Street breaks them up into little pieces called tranches. Gets them rated. We now know that was a real crock, but they get them rated, and they sell them out as securities. So we split the risk and reward. The people who are originating these loans, their incentive was to just sell loans. So they just did anything they could to sell the loans. The risk went to the back end, and they were so complicated. And the way they split these things up, and then they took the lower rated, you know, the highest risk pieces of these securities, and they wrapped them into collateral debt obligations. Doesn't matter if you're following all this, if you're familiar with it or not. And the point is they were complicated financial instruments and they hid the risk. But it wasn't going to be hid forever. I think one of the key lessons of this, one of the really key lessons, is that no one ever looked at the loan files. Whenever I was talking to people in different regulatory entities, I was screaming at them. They were like, well, the models all look good, you know. And when I, you know, a couple of times I lost my temper, I said, go look at the GD loan files. You know, look at what these loans are. I don't care what the models look like. There is no way this lending makes any sense. Of course the models look good. You know, housing prices are appreciating. They inflate the appraisals. They can get anybody refinanced the second time. You know, of course the models will look good because this is a new lending product. But the loan files were terrible. They were absolutely terrible. During this period, they were just ridiculous. The prior period, they were just really, really high cost. In this period, they became highly imprudent. Now, I'll walk you real quick through the rest of this. In addition to subprime lending, there became alternative mortgage products that were sold to near prime or many, many times prime borrowers. So subprime, at its height in 2006, remember that 22% figure is there. But in 2003... we had 8% subprime, but 2% alt-A. By 2006, this alternative mortgage market had gone to 18%. And a lot of that was things like the option ARM that I'll talk about. That was the classic Alt-A product. 40% of all new loans were subprime or Alt-A. 40%. And that's how we got here. Not only were these loans incredibly risky, and not only were they based on really imprudent lending practices, but the volume of these became astronomically high. Here's the typical Alt-A, you know, option ARM product. You have three choices. You can pay a 30-year amortization rate, which is higher monthly payment. You can make an interest-only payment, lower monthly payment. Or if you're really smart, you choose the low, low monthly payment, which is actually negative amortizing. You're going backwards in the equity in your home during this. So the typical, but at some point, and these option ARMs typically are 5 years, at some point at 5 years, it has to convert to an amortizing loan. So it has to switch so that it will pay itself off over the rest of the term of the loan. And that results in these huge price jumps on the monthly payments. Here's the bad news. Subprime price jumps are based on these 228 products we haven't talked about. That means a loan where you have 2 years fixed rate and then it jumps. And that's what you're hearing about with these rate resettings. These are mostly subprime loans that are hitting that 2 and sometimes 3 year mark where they reset. Alt-A products have a longer tail. They reset a little bit along the way, but at 5 years, they jump. So we have a whole nother rate resetting coming from these Alt-A loans in the 2004 through 2006 period, which had 5 years. Those start to reset next year, primarily, and peak around 2011, 2012. Okay, so we have a whole nother reset coming after this. Now, I love this graph also because I borrowed it from a friend of mine who was the chief enforcement regulator of banking at the state of Washington, and out there, you know, the values are higher. This is the typical $500,000 loan, you know. So Minnesotans find this funny. I gave a presentation out in California with foreclosure rescue scam issues, which is totally different, where I written this law we got passed here in 2004. It's been replicated all over the country. And I used a real example of someone in St. Paul who had a house worth $180,000 with a, you know, $140,000 loan. And I gave this presentation in San Francisco, and they just were in the farts. That's lunch money, you know? A house for $180,000, my gosh. I had a picture of it. Oh, my God. Yeah. Okay. All right, and this is something that is actually faxed to me just, you know, 6 or 9 months ago. So this is how it works. Option one, 5.875%, 30-year fixed. Option two, you know, this interest-only payment. Boy, the really good deal, the 1.99% ARM. That's the one you really want. Okay, subprime lending. One of the things you hear is that, well, but subprime lending did good. It raised minority home ownership. It brought in a whole bunch of new homeowners. Only about 9% of subprime loans went to first-time new home buyers. They were overwhelmingly refinance loans that were targeted at people who had equity as the result of this massive home appreciation that occurred over this long period where we had this huge run-up in housing values. And then they would aggressively solicit people to basically pull the equity out of their house. These were refinance loans, and then the remainder were people who were already homeowners moving to a new home. This was not new home ownership, but it provided a great accounting trick, because every time you made a home loan that was subprime to a new homeowner, it was a credit to the bank. You created a new homeowner. The flip side is all the loans that are going to go into foreclosure, the subprime loans, those don't come due until later. And because of this huge rise in housing prices, they didn't come due to much later. So when you start to go back and say, okay, all the loans that were originated in 1999, let's subtract the number of people who were ultimately foreclosed from the number of new homeowners that were created. And for every year from 98 to 06, you created a deficit. More people are going to be foreclosed than were created. The net result of subprime lending will be a huge drain on home ownership in America. This is just an old graph now, December 2006, but I still use it all the time. This is just a little slice of North Minneapolis. Every one of those dots was a home in foreclosure at the time, December. Not had been foreclosed. It was in the foreclosure process during December 2006. You have to double that for December 2007. Okay? And I mean, there's homes with 4 and 5 foreclosed houses on them. The concentration, this is an old map from Jeff Crump here on the St. Paul campus in the design school. You can see the black dots are the foreclosures. The darker brown areas are areas of greater poverty concentration. There's rather an overlay And here's what St. Paul looks like, and you'll see this. Just get a gestalt of this. Now look at this. Same map, isn't it? Different colors. This is foreclosed homes in St. Paul, the concentration. This is abandoned and vacant properties. The end game of foreclosure is abandoned and vacant properties. And when I've met with Hennepin and Ramsey County and talked to them, I said, look, I don't know that much about this issue. But if I were you, and this was last year, a year ago, and I've continued to talk to them about this, if I were you, if you really want to get ahead of this as a county with something you can do, you know, don't talk about mortgage lending practices. That's old news. Develop a plan to deal with abandoned and vacant properties, because that's the end game of this. All right, lastly, and what time have we got up there? I can't see. Okay, I'm good. I'll just end with this. Lastly, what are we going to do about it? Well, at the federal level, I'm happy to answer any of your questions about some of the proposals that are developing at that level. At the state level, there's a series of different things that have happened, increased loan counseling money, that kind of thing. Bottom line, in my opinion, if you really want to deal with the crisis, you're just going to have to do something with all these people in foreclosure that gives them real, tangible options to deal with the problem. The first graph, the dark gray, is the number of projected loans for 2008 that will go into foreclosure, and that's over 33,000. So in statewide, there'll be more than 33,000 loans this year, approximately seven to eight times the historic average. They're Great Depression numbers. If you knock off investor-owned residential properties, you get down to this slightly lighter gray line, and those are owner-occupied properties that are going to go into foreclosure this year. If you then deal with just the percentage of the owner-occupied properties that are subprime or just negative amortizing, remember like the option arms where you're actually paying less, you know, it's now illegal as a result of our bill last year, that's the white bar. And then if you get to those loans that were made after January 1, 2001 and before August 1, 2007 when the anti-predatory lending law went into effect, you get to that red line. It's about half, about 15,000 borrowers. And what the foreclosure deferment bill would do is it would provide the opportunity for someone in this targeted group. So the point of the bill is you target owner-occupied properties that got one of these types of abusive loans during this period of incredibly excessive lending. And you say, if you're in foreclosure, you can defer the foreclosure by filing an affidavit of deferment with the lender, and then you have to pay an amount equal to 65% of your last monthly payment or the payment you had at the time of origination. And if you ever miss one of those payments, they can reinstitute the foreclosure. And here's the reason for this bill. And here, it's now on the floor of the House and the Senate. And here's what this bill is trying to do. It's trying to bridge us from today, when 1,000 people a month that are in this group, more, are getting thrown out of their homes, to the federal solutions that are developing. And there's a wide variety of federal solutions that are being debated and talked about, both with the presidential candidates and in Congress. But they're not there yet. But we're at this flood of foreclosed homeowners. So the point of this bill is to try to bridge us, to try to target the group that you can help, and then target it further to people who can make substantial payments, so that they have a realistic prospect of owning their home at the end of this with some help by restructured loans, new FHA money, whatever the federal solutions that develop are, so that they'll get to the point when the federal solutions develop that they can actually take advantage of them. Let's not kid ourselves. The choice is really stark here. If you don't do this, we're going to continue to throw out 1,000 people a month. That's horrible for the families that get thrown out. I mean, it's some unbelievable levels of foreclosure. It's terrible for communities because that property then becomes abandoned and vacant property. Even if it doesn't, if it's in nicer neighborhoods, it will depress housing prices because we already have a depressed housing market, and then we're dumping, you know, an additional 15,000 homeowners onto the market that arguably could be saved with a little federal assistance or some sort of plan to deal with this to force loan restructurings. So that's the theory of the bill. And again, it's on the House and Senate floors. I'll do a little pitch, call your representative, legislator, encourage them to support the bill, and we'll talk about the pros and cons. It's all in there, and let's have a discussion.
First, I want to say I'm a senior citizen, and I'm Minnesotan, and I'm prudent, and my mortgage has been paid off. But I just heard my Congressman, Keith Ellison, speak on the same subject, and I also know what a good attorney general we have in the state of Minnesota and all the good work you must have done over the years. But I did make one suggestion, having had three mortgages in my lifetime, and it's a no-fault thing, but when you're spending that much as an investment, I always had an attorney look at everything, okay? I went to the university. But I think we need some regulation, and Keith Ellison agreed with me, like a second party reading it. It got a little greedy. And then besides all of that, a lot of people have taken out home equity loans on top of all of that, and that's like giving somebody a free credit card.
I agree with you. I think that we did need more regulation, and we do for the future. It's not really going to affect the problem now because subprime and NEGAM type lending is basically collapsed. It doesn't exist anymore. And we're dealing with the consequences of that imprudent lending. Keith was a classmate of mine at the University Law School, and he introduced the bill that we passed in 2007 with a few tweaks in Congress last year. And I think that's the right thing to do, to try to get better regulation. We also need to, this essentially, the guts of this happened as an intersection between unregulated loan originators, mortgage brokers, et cetera, unregulated loan originators and Wall Street money. Basically, there was this connection between the two. And I think that everyone has now recognized, radicals like Ben Bernanke and, David Brooks, wrote an article, the real crazy leftists out there, have now all basically said, well, we need regulation, Thanks, guys. but glad you think so. So I think there's a consensus that there was a lack of regulation here. I'm not sure exactly how many times we need to learn this lesson. We continue to basically, learn this lesson over and over and over again, and I'm not quite sure why. I don't get it.
I'm not familiar with the current bill language, but to what extent do you feel that city and county, especially metro area taxpayers, should step forward through their city and county governments to provide the bailout, for want of a better term, bailout assistance to the people whose mortgages have foreclosed? And what advantage do you see to those taxpayers if they do that?
It's a good question, too. It's the problem's way too vast to try to rely on local resources to refinance these mortgages. There's some reasons you don't want to just bail people out by just refinancing these mortgages. The problem is too vast. It would require way too much money. Even at the federal level, it would be astounding. At the local level, it really, it's not sensible to do that. So I wouldn't be for a bailout. There has been discussion at every level of local government about somehow using targeted funds as a way, when it was really important for community stabilization, to move in and buy properties that have already completed the foreclosure process, that's sitting there deteriorating. Does it make sense to go in and buy those properties, at the county level? That discussion, and then you're just weighing, how you're going to spend your money to deal with this abandoned vacant property problem. And that's the high buck approach to dealing with it. But in some cases, that may be the right tool. Particularly if you have a multiple toolbox and you use that judiciously and in a sparing way. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
40-plus years ago, I was in the mortgage business, and there were very strict guidelines. On conventional loans, you maybe made loans of 75 or, if you really pushed it, 80% of value, and the principal interest, taxes, and insurance payments on that house could not exceed something like 33% of a person's annual income. And when the home was appraised, you'd got a MAI appraisal. And, of course, maybe back then they were prophetic because we used to refer to MAI appraisals as made as instructed. But anyway, my question is, what happened? how is it that we got away from those guidelines? Where was the breakdown? What caused this thing just to go so bizarre?
I don't know. It did. I think the best way to answer that question is, you know, those, in fact, you know, when you look at the way that the regulation, the disclosure regulations, you know, the pieces of paper you get when you do a loan that nobody reads, the disclosure regulations were written with the concept, for instance, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which regulates your use of your credit report and denial of credit based on credit reports. When it was written, there was an assumption that credit was a binary decision. You either got credit or you didn't get credit, right? And those are things you're talking about. You know, then we were introduced to the concept of risk pricing credit. So it wasn't quite so much you got it or you didn't. That choice was still there. Many people were denied. But then there was this large continuum between denial and acceptance where, you didn't get prime credit, but you were charged more based upon your credit risk. There's nothing wrong. That's good, in my opinion. I think it's good to have subprime lending. I think securitization is good because it drove down the cost by pooling all that risk and being able to sell it off into a broader market with pooled risk. I think securitization drove down the cost, and that was good. The problem came when we took these financial structures, credit structures of risk pricing, which is essentially what was the underlies subprime lending, and combined it with securitization. And we did it in an environment completely absent of meaningful regulation or structures. And then we threw on that an environment of extremely low return, where the returns on this were much higher. Okay, let me answer your question. Ronald Reagan. That's essentially what the answer to your question is. I mean, you know, we got to the point where we said, government's the problem, not the solution. Well, what a silly way to think about things, in my opinion. I mean, it's just, you know, we basically devalued, you know, the stability that comes from an effective, thought-out government regulatory structure. We told smart people, don't go into government. You know, it's, you know, real, you know, that's just the dull bulb area, you know, and you want to go where the action of money is. And then we, you know, beat down people who were regulators, called them bureaucrats, and took away all their power and said, the market will fix it. And then we had the S&L crisis. Oh, little glitch. Then we had the Enron crisis. Oh, not a little glitch, you know. And the runaway stock. I mean, we just keep having these same things happen over and over again. So to me, I don't understand why we're so adverse in this country to, you know, fundamental sound government regulation. I think it's really hurting our brand across the world. New York is no longer the money center. They claim it's because of the regulations on the corporate and regulation, you know, after Enron. You know, I don't buy that, but maybe there's some truth in that. But fundamentally, you know, America became the money center of the world because we had, following the Great Depression, when things were in chaos, we instituted clear, sound principles for regulating our financial system. And starting in 1981, we began to attack and dismantle those systematically for 25 years. To me, that's essentially the answer I would give. And that's wrong, and we ought to turn around and just re-regulate in a principled, smart, you know, smart way. You know, there are costs to regulation. You have to weigh the costs against, et cetera. But if you have this mindset of, you know, all government is bad, you know, you wind up with this. You wind up with this. So it's my answer. Call me crazy. In the Netherlands, I'd be like, what's wrong with that? Yeah. Yeah, it's a normal approach. In the United States, you know, you're crazy if you say something like that. But
in the front here?
In the midst of this mania that went on with the lending, Congress decided to change the bankruptcy laws and provided that it was more difficult for people to eliminate their debts, had to restructure their debts, and in the process seemed to make housing less valuable, less of a valued asset in terms of protecting yourself on the long term. Would you comment on what you think bankruptcy law had to do with this?
Okay, can I go back and answer your question again? Ronald Reagan and campaign contributions from the financial services industry, which gave us bankruptcy reform. It was a wonderful, wonderful notion. Paul Wellstone was a hero. Paul Wellstone fought that when no one else would fight that. He stood up and said, this is wrong. You cannot do this. You cannot take away people's rights in bankruptcy, you know, to basically have a new start, et cetera, and you know, treat them like, you know, debtor prisons, essentially, and do nothing to regulate the explosion of unregulated credit that is putting us in this position in the first place. He eventually lost that fight, but he delayed it for many, many years. So I want to first say that. Did the bankruptcy reform, which was anti-consumer and was, I think, fairly clearly the result of the number one financial contributors to the political process was the financial services industry, and they just got what they wanted, you know? Did that contribute to this problem? No, I don't think it did. I don't think that consumers were thinking things through that clearly. The way it might have contributed, and one I suppose could study this, although it'd be hard, is that consumers had less of an incentive to use bankruptcy as an alternative to discharging their unsecured credit card debt that was out of control. And so turn to this. The number one pitch for subprime lending was, we can lower your overall monthly payments. And then they would get their medical debt and their credit card debt. And that was it. You know, we'll lower your overall monthly payments by wrapping in this, they didn't tell you this, wrapping in this unsecured debt and secured it by your home. So then when you don't pay this, you lose your home. So I suppose bankruptcy could have done that, but it occurred late enough where it doesn't correlate with the curve on subprime lending. I think the pitch was strong and people weren't thinking it through at that level, but I can't think of any other connection. Now, what it does do is it means it's so much harder to get out of these holes once you're in them as a family. And so cleaning up the problem is worse because of the bankruptcy reform. One of the two primary proposals to deal with this was debated on the Senate floor today and tabled, 56 to 30-something, was Senator Dick Durbin's proposal to provide authority to the bankruptcy courts to require loan modifications for, again, he'd do the same thing this bill kind of does, is targets this type of lending, this subprime neg-am lending during this period, and says bankruptcy courts should have the ability to enforce loan modifications for these loans based on reasonable ability to pay and all these other factors. Right now, the law allows that for commercial loans, but does not allow that for residential home loans. There's a specific provision saying a residential home loan cannot be modified by the bankruptcy court. So it would get rid of that prohibition and allow the modification loans by bankruptcy courts, which allows a case-by-case determination to modify the loans to save people who can be saved, and then simply to not do it where borrowers didn't have the capacity from a court that has the capacity to look at those kinds of transactions and do it. And that is one of the two federal proposals that will really make a difference. So I hope that that gets back on the agenda.
Could you say something about the role that Fannie Mae may have played in all of this?
Fannie Mae, you know, I don't have enough expertise. I met with Fannie Mae during this over the appraisal issues and a couple of other things. I had long discussions with the OCC and Fannie Mae and a couple of other actors here, along with some state attorney generals. And I just organized a group of state AAGs, assistant attorney generals, who were working in this area with me. There was just five or six of us doing all these cases, basically, these 10 years. And, you know, I said, you know, we got to go talk to the OCC about different issues where they were trying to block state attorney generals from taking actions against banks. And we've got to go talk to Fannie Mae about this set of issues. I didn't go anywhere in talking to them. My major memories of both those meetings was that bankers like quiet offices. Julie Williams, who later was the acting controller who met with us at the time, was the legal counsel. You know, we got into this meeting and, you know, she came in a little later, so we were sitting there for 5 minutes, and some of her staff was there, and then she comes in, and, you know, we're talking, and she sits down, and they just shut up immediately when she enters the room, and I'm like, okay. And so she sits down, and she goes, thank you for coming. We're all, like, leaning over. It's like,
we appreciate you coming to the OCC to discuss these important matters with us. You know, and I thought, well, there's only Fannie Mae. Same thing. You know, I got in there. They're very quiet offices.
Prentice, the reason I'm asking is not a very substantive answer. About 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, I was actually on an advisory committee for Fannie Mae.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
When they rolled out this new product called subprime mortgages.
Yeah.
And it was connected with their initiative to get 1 billion new homeowners by the end of the century. And I mean, it just seems to me that there was an assumption that I kept hearing from them over and over and over. Home ownership is a good thing.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting in a room with Gail Sincott and we'd say, how about if people built more good rental housing for people rather than getting folks into housing who can't afford it and can't maintain it? And it just seemed a runaway train that you couldn't derail.
Well, yeah, I didn't want to go into it because I haven't thought enough about, there's Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and let's go backwards for those, I should go back. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the two primary government-sponsored entities which created the secondary market for mortgages. Back when you were originating mortgages, they would be originated by a bank typically, and then they would be held in the portfolio of the entity that originated it. This provides the incredibly unusual concept of caring about the risk in the loan. It's called portfolio lending, and it was the standard way to originate mortgages. Now, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac did, in many, they lowered the cost of lending. And they lowered the cost of lending by saying, okay, you don't have to do that. You don't have to hold all these mortgages. What you can do is you can, you know, originate these mortgages, and we'll put them into great big bundles, and then we'll take these bundles and we'll sell them as a security so that the owner of the security owns this income stream from these mortgages, and the risk they own is the risk of default on the mortgages. And, of course, these are home loans, so we know they won't default. They'll default at very low levels, haha. And, therefore, they pay off. So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac created the secondary market. It had the effect of substantially lowering the price of mortgage lending. That's good. It had the bad effect of separating, to some extent, risk and reward, but there were all kinds of guarantees, all kinds of systems put in place by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to make sure that didn't happen so that the lending occurred under certain guidelines. I have some knowledge, but just enough to be dangerous, about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's entry into subprime lending and then creating the market for secondary lending. But what I will say is the loans that really got us into trouble were not Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac sponsored loans, but they own a huge percentage of this portfolio, and they have some share of this problem. They certainly didn't do anything to check it. Nobody along the way, other than a few crazies, you know, like me, who were just screaming at, you know, I can be calmer now, and this is relatively calm for me. I mean, because now everyone gets it. You know, a few years ago, I was like, you don't get this. This is a disaster brewing. You know, that's what I was trying to do with Fannie Mae. It's like, pay attention here. You know, but I don't know enough about Fannie's and Freddie's involvement in subprime. They certainly were involved. They bear some responsibility for not paying attention to setting the standards for their lending. But I will say that most of this secondary market securitized lending occurred through firms like Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and all these other firms that bundled these debts and sold them outside of the Fannie Freddie structure. Those were the worst loans. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yes.
My question is, I appreciate all the information that you're giving us. But if we looked at it from a slightly different perspective, what we see when you talk about 1,000 people a month are being left homeless, and I think this cries out for a sense of justice in the community, that not only do we need to have regulations, and not only do we need to have programs in place to help the victims, but I think the community needs a sense of justice to have the people that were responsible for this prosecuted. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I agree. I can now say this fearlessly, although I used to say it. The head of AmeriQuest was called Roland Arnall. And I, along with a guy in D.C., held up Roland Arnall's appointment by the Bush administration to be ambassador to the Netherlands for 6 months. on exactly that principle. He's the head of the largest subprime lender in America during the worst period of subprime lending. He became fabulously wealthy. We're talking billionaire-level wealthy from this lending. And, you know, I said that he should be in an orange jumpsuit, not an ambassador to the United States. Definitely. You know, the risk of being sued for whatever. Now I can do that because he actually died, and I'm sorry for that. But, you know, he's a human. But you know, he to me epitomized, you know, what's wrong here. And I do think that we should have gone after hard. And there now is, as always happens retrospectively, that there are prosecutions going on. The small fish are easier to catch than the big fish. That's how it always is, right? So it's going to be hard to get the people who are in control of these big companies. It's much easier to get the mortgage brokers and the people who did the shady deals with the builders and those sorts of things. So that's where most of the prosecutions are. Our local U.S. Attorney's Office, which is fabulous, has done a lot of this good work for many years and has tried to put more resources into it. But essentially, the people who really should, there should be people paying back money, but you're never going to get enough out of the people who really brought this, you know, to get a sense of justice about that, in my opinion. I sure would have liked to have seen that, though. And that is where I broke with the Ameriquest settlement. I went over to the U, and so I gave that up, and they settled after I left. I was the hawk. And I was like, no, we're going after Roland Arnell personally. You know, if they say they don't have the money, it's there. Let's just trace it back. And let's find the people who profited, and let's take it back. And partly because this was before it had all imploded. But I was very express about this, and I talked to someone who I worked with on this, a high-level politician type, and you know, we had this discussion. He said, you know, you used to rail at us, and I got really mad, but, you know, you were right. And I was like, yeah, great satisfaction there. Thank you. You know, but I was like, you know, it's like, this is a coming disaster, and I want, when this disaster hits and people care to listen to what we have to say about this, unlike now, I want to say we did everything to recover every dollar we could from the people who did the worst lending here. So I have that same sense of that. It's hard. The system's not set up to make that easy, but there's reasons for that too.
In the front of the house here.
Yeah. Would you talk about the role, if there is one, for down payments or having the homeowner have some equity or some stake in property? It seems that we don't, and it's easy to run or easy to overspend based on that and then walk.
Yes. Where are the hard questions? I'm so used to everyone asking me all the hard questions. No, these are more sophisticated questions, but you know, the hostile questions. So yeah, aren't these people just stupid? And are there the three factors that are most caused the problem. One of them was 100% and greater loan-to-value lending. So exactly what that was a critical factor in this imprudent lending scheme. Stated income loans, failure to verify income, basically. Give people the loans that they no possibility of paying back. And this no equity lending, this 100% loan-to-value. And 100% loan to value with a piggyback second loan on it, that home equity loan that someone was mentioning before back here, you know, that was another huge factor in what made this lending so imprudent. I think that that's reversed, and I think people are going to have to put down more now. And one of the problems here, and again, you know, again, I don't want us to overreact. And that doesn't mean, you know, no government regulation. I mean, it means being sensible about how we do this. There are advantages to having lower down payments for people to get them into home ownership. And it's not like a black and white thing. It's just being smart about managing risk is all it is. And we lost our sense about how to manage risk, so we were just shoveling money at people with no down payments at all, and we were layering that. It was risk layering is what it's called. We're layering that risk with stupid things like stated income loans. You know, you don't have to prove you have the income. and negative amortization so that you're actually going backwards even though there was no equity to begin with. And, you know, so you had all this layering of all these risky products on top of each other, and, you know, we just lost our sense of control. But that was an important one, an important control that we lost. And what's the result of that now, and this is where I actually intersect with economists. I found economic thinking, and I did graduate work in economics until I said, what do we do? This makes no sense in, like, human life. You know what I mean? It's like these models all are very – I liked it because, you know, you got right answers, and I was good at math. So, you know, it's like I felt like such a good student. And then I said, you know, but what we're doing here, just – I'm having a hard time relating that to, like, my experience in life. And so I often have that – consumer advocates often have that problem with economists. Economists come very certain. You know, they're very certain. You know, this is how things work. This is how it is. It's like, you know, it's all based on these models, which are based on assumptions, which lead you to results that you forget they were based on the assumptions, and so I'm not sure how valuable they are. But one of the important studies in this area, the economists done, that I think is basically true, is that people walk away from loans when they don't have any equity in them, when the times shift and housing values depreciate. So one of the things that happened is when you used to have 80% LTVs, in other words, you used to have 20% down, and then the housing value stagnated, or even if they dropped a little, you were still committed to that house because you had equity in it. But when you get 100% LTV loans, and you live in North Minneapolis, and your housing value drops, I mean, this is actually about right, 40% in a year or two, then... You know, that's where you get, you know, jingle mail, where you mail in the keys, which is bad for all of us. It's really bad for all of us. And I agree with what Judith was saying, or no, somebody was saying about, you know, why not just, rent more often. I mean, it's home ownership is good, and I'm actually for home ownership, and it's good, but only when it's only when it's sustainable. So the goal shouldn't be home ownership; it should be sustainable home ownership. So you have to plan to do that. So it's kind of, it's just a risk balancing. So I'm not for the return to 20% loan down payments, but I'm for the return to when you have a low down payment, then you shouldn't layer on any other risk with that, and you should probably include it with some counseling planning for finances and other things to ensure that those loans are sustainable.
Let's get a question in the back of the house. Russ?
When you mentioned something about the Netherlands,
yeah,
and it sounds like you've got a lot of local, national, and international experience, and when you talk to a group like this, you are, in a sense, preaching to the choir. I think this is a very receptive audience.
Yes, I noticed that.
And when you
mention... I'm used to hostile audience.
And when you mention Ronald Reagan, I think many of us here are very prone to say, well, yeah, okay, let's blame Ronald Reagan, or let's blame some other politician or something like that. But you've also mentioned the fact that there are great cultural differences. So it's not, if Ronald Reagan was effective, it was because he was effective in this culture. His message had a receptive audience, just as your message here has a receptive audience to hear it. What's the difference? I know I'm asking you to stop being an attorney and an economist and to be a cultural anthropologist in a way. But do you have any comments on that?
Well, if you haven't noticed, I haven't been real bounded by my professional sense ever in my life. You know, professions to me are great, but, you know, you should be, you know, we all have good knowledge, including, you know, everybody. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think Ronald Reagan was speaking to something core in American values, and Americans have different values. And the trick when you do this work, and I'm not always that good at it, to be perfectly honest. That's, you know, people have asked me to run for attorney general many times, and I said, you really got to know me better. You know, you realize I'm not really that good at this. The trick is, and again, Paul Wellstone, for instance, is just superb at framing things in a way that made sense. So the trick is to try to, you know, hit the core values people have and frame them, your discussion of what we should be doing with these issues in a way that connects with those core American values. We haven't always done that well, those of us who've advocated for these. positions of consumer protection, for instance, is what I've been doing. So I think that there is a lot of room to grow in terms of that. I will, however, say that we kind of need, it's time for us to, and I was talking to someone about this the other day, so I'll just say it the way I was talking to a friend. It's time for us to grow up as a culture in some ways. I mean, I think we've hit kind of like a break point. And this crisis is just one of the long series of crises. But it's time for us to just grow up a little bit about the fact that we have social connection, that we didn't make all of our money because we were brilliant and, you know, better risk takers than the people who were poor. And we need to just, I think there's some principles we need to learn from the Europeans about social acceptable minimal levels of social support and engagement. So it's time to just stop, and here is where I sometimes lose it when I'm up at the legislature advocating for these things. Some bills are easy and they're technical, and I just go up and I'm the technician and the technocrat and go through the language and what's the implication of this language. On this bill, I've kind of raised my voice a couple of times, which I haven't done previously, because I want people to say, do you realize how many people are getting thrown out of their house every week? My friend Amber Hawkins, that is at Legal Aid, was in a meeting with me the other day, thank goodness, when I was saying, what's the human cost here? And if you're willing to accept that, fine, but I want you not to minimize that. I want you to put that front and center when you're thinking. And she said, look, I was with a client at Hennepin County Housing Court who was getting evicted from a foreclosed loan with the company MERS, which we won't go into. It's the largest forecloser. It's this electronic registration system. It's the largest forecloser in the state. There were 30 people in one afternoon being evicted from foreclosed homes by this one lender, the largest forecloser, but still, in Hennepin County. I mean, the scope of this is really amazing. And people tend to be very ashamed, and they fall in a hole. But I want people to really understand the scope of this. And if you don't pass this deferment, if the state doesn't pass this deferment bill, and Governor Pawlenty doesn't sign it, and we will effectively, we can pretend otherwise, but we will effectively be saying to all those people, tough luck. And to me, it's time to just stop blaming people. Were these people partly responsible? Absolutely. You know, should these people have known better on these loans? Many times, yes. Many times they were duped, but sometimes people participated in being duped in these loans. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And that's where the growing up piece is, separating out these deserving and undeserving homeowners. And I'm straying a little bit, but I'll make one more point. Governor Pawlenty talked about this. They had a press conference this week. And so they asked him. He was there to announce this loan counseling money, which is good. Great. Let's have more loan counselors. More loan counselors won't solve the fundamental problem, because the fundamental problem is the lenders don't want to negotiate with the homeowners because they have no incentive to do so, and they're kind of a mess, and they have a hard time getting to their interest because the securitization has broken up the ownership so much that it's driven by the servicer, not the lender, yada, yada. The bottom line is, until there's some mandatory system for making lenders come under certain principles and rewrite loans that can salvage people and their houses, most of these people are going to get pitched out. So the press corps, which was aware of the deferment bill, asked Pawlenty about this, and it was a focus of the press conference. And his response is he would likely veto the bill, or probably, I wasn't there. NPR reported it as, I think, you know, is leaning against signing the bill if it makes it through the House, because it would dry up credit. And the impoverished discussion part of this to me is this. That makes no sense, and I'm having a hard time figuring out how to get the message why that makes no sense. When you increase the price of regulation, you often will drive up the price of credit or decrease its availability. That's true. But in this situation, that makes no sense. None at all, because there is no more securitized subprime credit out there right now. And negative amortization loans are illegal. So it can't possibly have an effect on the credit market. The American Securitization Forum showed up at committee hearings on this bill. The national people flew in from D.C. The banker said, and the people representing creditors said, this is a nuclear bomb. They never come to a state to testify. I don't know that it's ever happened. This shows you the extent to which credit will disappear in the state if this happens. They showed up and they testified against this bill and threatened, extorted. I never got a chance to respond, but had I had a chance to respond, I would have said, the Securitization Industry Trade Association showing up here, it should have been with buttons that say, we apologize. How can we help to solve the problem? Not extorting and threatening us over this. And there's an impoverished debate around this that's based on this notion of individual responsibility, which is important. But there's also a collective responsibility that these systems run in an effective way that doesn't take advantage of people. And in this particular debate, on this particular issue, that credit, drying up of credit and increasing the price of credit is a complete ruse. And it makes no sense. And the only way it would happen is if the industry somehow got together to drive up the price of prime credit because they're mad at what we did in a financially irrational way, which I don't believe would happen. If that's the governor's rationale for not supporting this bill, I find that he should pick an argument that has more substance to it. Or just say the truth, which is we can bail out Bear Stearns with $30 billion, which I think was a good move, had to do that to stabilize the financial markets. We can bail out Bear Stearns with $30 billion and not say a word, but if we try to do anything for homeowners that's real, that is requires lenders to take action to share the loss here. They shared the blame. They broke the vase. They're going to have to share in paying for it. If you do anything to do that, it's off the table in a doctrinaire conservative world. And I really hope that the governor will look hard at this and say, hold on, this is a sensible proposal. It doesn't fit within my construct of what I like to have happen normally, but this isn't normal times. And I hope the governor will take a hard look at that, which is a long way from your question, and I apologize.
Yeah. There's a question on the far side of the room.
My question is, you talked about the economic scope and the human victims of this. When I looked at your picture of the neighborhoods with all the red dots in it, what I saw was police presence expanded greatly, drug, schools, budgets being cut because students aren't in those schools. So it seems to have tentacles that reach every other facet of human mankind and our needs in the community.
When you concentrate abandoned and vacant properties like this, there's really good studies on this, on the tremendous cost of concentrating abandoned and vacant properties. The net result of this crisis in these neighborhoods, I don't have the maps here with me, but one of the things to keep in mind is we're going way past where it started in North Minneapolis. You know, this continues to expand out. But when you look at the core of the worst hit areas and the poorest areas of town and the devastation from abandoned and vacant properties, it's really astounding. And the studies are just really consistent because what happens is they substantially drive down the price of surrounding properties. They increase the cost of city services to take care of these properties and all the problems you mentioned. It's exactly right, West. And they drive down the tax base. And then you get this downward negative cycle where you're driving down the tax base while the service costs are going up on the collective level and on the individual level. You're reducing the value of property on that block and in that neighborhood, which then fuels more foreclosures as more people go underwater on their homes and have no options to sell or refinance. So you get this negative reinforcing cycle. I'm really worried about the effect. We haven't been talking about this. I have been for a year, but we haven't been talking about this effect of abandoned properties. And I'm really concerned that 2 years from now, we're all going to be seeing what the costs of not dealing with that are. I will say, Minnesota government we do our best here. We have really good government here, in my opinion. And the counties have really, and the cities, are really working hard to try to figure out how to get their hands around this. It's a big problem, but they were proactive, both Hennepin and Ramsey counties, about trying to address these problems before they got too hard, too big.
Holly, you have a question in the back?
You may not be able to answer this, but if your bill passes, it still only takes care of half the problem. What do we do?
Well, that's true, and it doesn't even take care of that, because that's just the number of people eligible. And then those people would have to file an affidavit, and they'd have to make the payments, and a certain percentage of these people can't make the payments. In my opinion, you have to take this thing in layers, and you have to just develop strategies that get as many pieces as you can. But to me, if you want, the first piece to focus on is keeping as many people in their homes as we can who at the end of this cycle are going to be able to stay in their homes. And so that to me is the first, that's the first thing you want to do, because it's a double loss. You've taken a homeowner out of their home, the personal tragedy of that, and then the collective tragedy of putting those houses on a market, often in poorer areas where they're going to go abandoned or vacant, or, you know, further depress real estate prices. So it seemed to me that that's simply the first approach. The other homes, many of these homes are non-owner occupied. This 20% is statewide, but if you look at the areas we're talking about, like North Minneapolis, the number of non-owner occupied properties that are going into foreclosures is much higher than that. It's, the numbers suggest somewhere between a third and a half. And those homeowners, the percentage of outright fraud in those transactions is really quite high. So the answer to your question is you have to have multiple strategies to attack multiple problems. And this, for me, the starting point is keeping as many people as possible in their homes where there's a realistic possibility with enforced loan modification or new expanded FHA money with loss sharing required that would stabilize that group. And then to look at how you deal with these abandoned and vacant property problems and how you deal with the real estate problems. So you have to take it in pieces, boxes. Wherever.
Do you have the bill number off the top of your head?
SF3396, the Senate file. Yeah, you can go onto the website and pull it up, Minnesota Senate website. Just put SF3396 and it'll come up.
Having being a resident in one of the neighborhoods in North Minneapolis, and being part of a neighborhood organization where we've been given funding to look specifically at the foreclosure crisis in the area, we can honestly speak to the fact that a lot of the houses in our area are investor properties. People are being thrown out right at the sheriff's sale after it's been rented two and three times. But the sheer devastation and the loss of human capital in the area is large. Never mind. Also coupling that with those same investors burning their properties down, that will also have an adverse effect on everyone's insurance, not just the insurance for those who live in my neighborhood, but those who live in other areas. So this is a problem that is really the Minneapolis community. It started much earlier in my area. People weren't paying that much attention because they were poor, they were black, and they were kids. And it didn't really affect me. Now it's something that is really, it's much larger, and it is starting to affect the pockets of others. But my question really is about looking at these families that have left, that couldn't afford their home when it was $250,000, but can afford the house at $60,000 and $70,000. How do we make pathways for them to be able to buy and rehab either their previous house or another house in the same area? How do we make pathways for that? But then on a side note to that, that there is this creeping notion of potential redlining to happen in this area. We all know that redlining is illegal. However, that there are starting to become practices of where lenders will allow loans to be made. They're doing proportional amounts of loans in certain areas. And so the concern is, will people be able to even buy properties in this area, or even those who've been foreclosed, be able to purchase a property that they can now afford in this area?
A lot there. I'll just address the last question. One of the problems that created this is greenlining or reverse redlining that happened with subprime lending. So the subprime lenders would actually focus on the areas where redlining had occurred in order to go in to take advantage of the housing appreciation that occurred in those areas. And now there is evidence of redlining back when the money is dried up for lending. One of the things that has been attempted to be addressed in some of the federal bills is making sure that the expanded FHA money is readily available for all areas. So I'm hoping that that's partly addressed by the federal problem. The rest of it was your comment, and what can I add to that? So,
the question here in front?
Yes. With 33,000 people being foreclosed, what's going to happen to the rental market? Is that price of rent going to start skyrocketing, or is it going to go down at the same time with the homes depreciating?
Actually, rental prices, I think, have been going up, but I haven't thought about this problem enough. I also have not thought about tenants as enough, but there are people who've done that. Like I know people at the St. Paul Legal Aid Group, and there was a group of people who worked on a bill with the effects of tenants and foreclosure, which is a different issue. But in terms of the increased demand when you convert homeowners to renters, you would think that that would add some demand. But on the other hand, it's a weakening market with a weakening economic condition, so maybe there's some counterbalance. It's all just speculation. I don't have a good answer.
We have time for about two more questions, and I think there are questions here in the back.
Yes, my question is, or my comment first is that as we consider the number of foreclosures, and we think primarily of those areas in Minneapolis and St. Paul where there are the preponderance of foreclosures, but they are spread throughout the entire metro area, Edina, Plymouth, you know, they're everywhere. But one of the things we need to keep in mind is that every time we see one of those dots where a family has been moved out of their home and that property is foreclosed, that property is not contributing to the tax base. So whatever city you live in, whatever county you live in, if you're expecting services from your government, whether it's plowing or street, whatever it is, there's going to be a lot less money to provide for that. So it really has an impact in the bottom line for every one of us, whether our home is being foreclosed or not. And then my question to you is, when you talked about that hockey stick line of foreclosures and that stick line going up, and we look at these massive numbers and 30 people in one day in the Hennepin County courts losing their homes, do you see that line continuing to go up for a while? And how much higher do you think that might go before it finally starts to level off and we've maxed out with all of those subprime loans?
Yeah, that question, I used to say I thought it was leveling out at the end of last year and the beginning of this year, and I was wrong, so what do I know? Subprime lending drove this, and that's what you can't forget. It's all driven by subprime lending now. But there's the second wave of Alt-A lending that's a little different and has a different character. There's also now the threatening economic conditions. So unemployment's starting to go up. Claims just rose. So the answer to your question is probably, tell me what the housing price values do in the next 2 or 3 years. Well, they've gone down so much, I mean, we don't know if they'll continue to drop. And what housing prices do, what income and unemployment does, and that will probably have a huge impact on it. But then there's kind of this unknown about all these Alt-A loans, and are they going to perform as badly as the subprime loans did in terms of foreclosures when the rates reset, or are they going to perform better, and do people have options? They are certainly more geographically spread. So you're going to see that wave hitting in a very different way if foreclosures are as high in that as they are in subprime, which is unlikely but entirely possible. A final answer to that is, you know, what I used to say, although now it's past this point, but why are we taking all this risk on? I mean, it's just, to me, it's just a risk issue. We just took on way, way, way too much risk in our mortgages, and we didn't used to use home mortgages as a risk, as a place of risk investment. And we need to get back to the idea, although we need to be prudent and be willing to take some risk, but we need to get back to the idea that home mortgages have a different character to their investment. Stop treating them like, you know, other financial instruments for consumers. But the answer to your question is I think it will stay high for a long time. I don't know whether it'll keep going up. There's scenarios either way.
Question all the way in the back on this side.
I've been led to believe that the Attorney General's office, the Real Estate Fraud Task Force, is not funded and that they are no longer going to be pursuing real estate fraud. Is that true?
Minnesota Financial Services Crime Task Force was defunded. Seems kind of an odd choice in this environment. That was not primarily the Attorney General's office. That was mostly, most criminal prosecution occurs at the county attorney's offices and the U.S. attorney. And in the white collar areas, basically Hennepin and Ramsey, but mostly the U.S. attorney's office. Those will continue to be funded. I don't think that's going to be as disastrous as people say. But there's just, you know, the number of cases to do versus the amount of resources is amazing. I mean, even within the Attorney General's office, people, you know, have this, you know, sense of a behemoth office, et cetera. I mean, really, it was me and about 4 to 6 other people at various times who did everything, not just mortgages, everything, telemarketing fraud, credit card cases, auto fraud, you know, everything you heard, Attorney General's, it was, you know, outside of the Cherries area, all the consumer stuff was just really a small number of people who made about as much as one partner at a major law firm. So, I mean, the amount of resources here, is really tiny relative to the amount of the problem. I love my job. I have the best job in the world teaching at the University Law School. Students are so smart, so much fun. I can come and talk to groups like this, not have to worry about my boss getting a tape and saying I've destroyed his election chances. It's a great job. But I don't have to worry about my boss, period, right? But the downside is, you know, what I miss about the Attorney General's office is the power. I mean, you know, I could just whip up an investigative demand, which I would take very seriously, but I could, you know, get an investigative demand and send it to a company, including a major company, and they had to turn over a bunch of documents to me, and the standard was, you know, just above you're not a lunatic, you know, with the lowest standard in law. There's a lot of power, but not many resources. I think the criminal stuff, though, really is, I don't think that's going to have as big of an impact as people think it will, although it's stupid.
Well, I hate to cut off the conversation, but I hope you will join me in thanking him not only for joining us this evening, but for all of his good work on all of our behalf.